A hospice is a place that you go to die, but it's so much more than that. This podcast from Loras Hospice will show you the extraordinary work that takes place there, the stories, the people, and above all, the patients and families who we support to make the worst time in their lives not quite so bad. In this episode, we explore the role of physio and occupational therapy in palliative care, how it helps improve quality of life, and how patients can keep their independence despite incurable illness. So today I'm here with Kerry and Hannah. Kerry is the clinical lead physiotherapist and Hannah is the clinical lead occupational therapist. And I think we could start by asking you both why we have your services at Loras. I think people are often confused as to why we have them. What is the role of physio and occupational therapy at Loras?
It's a good question. Because I think a lot of people and patients generally tend to think that there is no role for a physiotherapist or an occupational therapist in palliative care in a hospice setting. But we don't just support patients who are end of life, who are here to die. So we support patients who are who've come in to help with complex symptoms perhaps that can't be managed in the community. So we would support them in different ways to adapt to their current situation to help keep them as independent as possible, because we know the kind of the underlying goal for them is to remain as independent as possible. And you know, that might be, you know, things that we take for granted. So that might be taking a few steps to the bathroom, and if patients can't do that, we'll work with them. Well, how can we make that a bit easier? What can we use? Can we use any equipment? How can we do that? Because actually that's really important to them, to maintain a level of dignity, quality of life. It might mean that, you know, that's the difference between them staying in bed or getting out of bed. We will see patients at different stages of their diagnosis. That might be at the start of their diagnosis, that might be, you know, maybe a couple of years down the line, or it might be kind of 6 months. It very much depends on the person, but what we do is very much patient-centered, so it very much depends on what the patient wants to, or what's important to that particular patient.
Hannah, can you tell me a bit about how occupational therapy feeds into this? Is that more focused on people's home settings?
So yes, thank you, Daisy. So as occupational therapists or OTs, our role is around the why, really. So as much as Kerry's spoken about the physical, getting to and from the bathroom, actually it's finding out the person behind the goal or the desire to get out of bed, or what's important to them. So as a profession, we look at how somebody's home environment meets with their mental well-being, so their psychological well-being, how they're thinking, how they're feeling, their role, their purpose, their identity, but also their functional. So as Kerry said, getting to the bathroom, it's about what's the meaning behind getting up and getting out of bed. It's that level of dignity or autonomy, or being able to integrate with their family, to do things that make them feel good. Because I think behind everybody, whether it's, you know, a patient here at Loras or somebody at wider public, we've all got what drives us, what gives us our identity and sense of self. And that's the patient-centered focus that we offer here at Loras, whether it be in the day therapy, seeing people from an early point of diagnosis to straight through to the inpatient ward. And I think what's really great is that we have the opportunity to get to know our patients from an early stage, getting to know them getting to know us. So actually when people do come to the inpatient ward for symptom management or end of life care, actually we've already built up a therapeutic relationship with those people.
So for both of you, your areas of expertise are about understanding the person as much as the disease.
Definitely. Because everybody's got their story, and when somebody comes into the inpatient unit, as much as it's a really warm and welcoming place with wonderful pictures on the wall and we try to make it homely, it's not just somebody in the bed, it's a person with a story, a family, a history, an identity. Symptom management in palliative and end of life care is what we do, and energy, so like the way that what drives you, the energy that you have, you might wear out really quickly trying to do something that somebody else is expecting you to do. And I suppose we're we're kind of guardians of that energy, making sure that what people want to do is important, and they getting up washed and dressed, if that's what you that dignity and doing it yourself, we'll work on that. But actually, if it's going out and spending time with your family, we'll help you to get washed and dressed. So we just move things around. And we can't do that without finding out about that person and what's important to them. It's such a sensitive time in their life, and their family are trusting us to look after them. I think it's really important that we do find out that person behind the disease, because that's what it's all about, isn't it? It's about maintaining you.
Absolutely. Kerry, can you tell me a bit about breathlessness? That's a really common symptom, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
So we do see a lot of patients who perhaps struggle with breathlessness, and that might be cancer related, but it also might be kind of lung disease, other lung disease related, or heart failure related. So, you know, managing breathlessness is what we do really well here. So, you know, patients will, they feel like they're losing control. Breathlessness is a really, it's a really horrible, debilitating symptom, and it really restricts what patients can do. It's very frightening. And what will often happen then is patients will, they'll stop. They'll stop doing what they enjoy doing, or they'll stop doing what they want to do, because they think it's a really negative response, and it might be harmful. So a lot of our work with patients who experience breathlessness is around education, why you're experiencing that symptom as part of your as part of the disease process. So we talk a lot about that, so that they have more of an understanding. And whilst we can't necessarily change the breathlessness, what we can do is put somebody more in control. And that's the key thing, because what they have lost is the control. That breathlessness is impacting on everything. It's stopping them doing what they want to do. So it's about putting that patient back in control, but not just the patient, but the family and the carers as well, because often, you know, they feel very helpless. What, you know, I can't do anything. They're so, you know, they're so breathless. They're very frightened by it. I don't know what to do.
It creates a lot of anxiety, I imagine, as well.
It creates a lot of anxiety, and the anxiety will then feed into the breathlessness as well. So, you know, you've got a really vicious circle there. So we do a lot of talking around what it is, what it's impacting on, how they feel. About their breathlessness, how that's impacting on their activities, and we break that down. We look at it. Okay, what can we do to change that? Does that involve recovery strategies? Because the breathlessness will be there, but it's acknowledging that, and it's acknowledging that, but it's also acknowledging that it's okay. It's okay, and it's not going to stop you doing what you need to do.
Because I imagine it's like absolutely a normal family reaction to want to wrap your loved one in cotton wool and put their feet up and get them a cup of tea and don't move a muscle, I'll do everything for you. But that's probably quite counterproductive when it comes to trying to keep your mobility going.
Totally agree. And I was just hearing Kerry speak then, and it is about that. And what one thing that we try to do is to teach the carers the importance of actually allow somebody time. So we'll do all these education strategies and teach people not to avoid doing an activity. But you're absolutely right. It's very easy to say, just sit down, I'll do that. Don't move. But that's counterproductive to what we're trying to teach, is that actually the risk of avoidance, the risk of how that impacts on how you feel, what you do, and actually being able to maintain a level of function and be okay with that breathlessness. It's teaching the carers and the relatives, the loved ones, that actually work alongside somebody. It's not all or nothing. And it takes time. So we run breathlessness clinics here in outpatients, and a bit like the day therapy units, as early as we can, to teach people the strategies. So then it doesn't become a reactive, vicious cycle. It's actually, this is my breathlessness. This is how I manage it. And this is the support my family and friends give me. It's that ownership, that control, as Kerry was saying.
We're really lucky here because we've got amazing gardens and outdoor spaces, and if it's not too hot or too rainy, patients are encouraged to go outside, aren't they? With you guys, but also, you know, nurses push beds out into the courtyard so patients can feel the wind and the sun. Which
connecting
is,
with those senses, isn't it?
Exactly.
Amazing. I think that's one of the things we have to be aware of in our role, is that there are people who are coming into the inpatient unit who may have not felt fresh air for many months. They may have been in bed for a couple of weeks, or may not have been able or mobile enough to be able to access the outside. And just that importance of feeling and connecting with the outside world for some people who may historically have been gardeners, who may have had an allotment, or may have just enjoyed going to the seaside and feeling that fresh air. That's, yeah, we're always, I think one of our primary things is what's important to you, going back to that, but knowing what facilities we've got. So that's one of the privileges of working here, of actually we can facilitate that if that's what you'd like to do.
We use the grounds for rehabilitation purposes. So yes, we have, you know, a purpose-built gym and a clinical skills room, but we use the grounds because they are, you know, we have lovely grounds. The volunteers maintain them so well, and a lot people just like to be outside in the nicer weather. If somebody really does love gardening, and we did have a patient who really did love gardening, actually we tailor their rehabilitation to that, you know, for that purpose. So for example, once we'd managed to get a certain patient to a point where she was actually able to stand for a little while, we gave her a hose pipe, so she was hosing down the plants, and actually that challenged her balance, so we were working on her balance doing that. So that was the rehabilitation side, but actually that served a purpose for her. It was getting her back out into the garden and doing something that she enjoyed doing.
And that presumably provides some motivation as well to want to do it, so you're not just making up pointless exercises for people to do that they're not very engaged in. They're actually seeing the improvement and they're pursuing an interest almost, and remembering who they are maybe as well.
And that's the whole point of you know, our care here. It is patient-centered, so the person, the patient, as Hannah's already said, it's getting to know that person. What do they like doing? What's really important to them? Okay, so how can we support you to achieve that or to get there?
So I know you also regularly have students come and join you to train from Leicester University often. Tell me a bit about that.
One of the big things that I think both OT and physio students will get from, you know, placements within the palliative care setting, particularly here, is they learn about what a holistic assessment really is. So when we talk about a holistic assessment, we're not talking just about, you know, someone's physical problems or just their disease and what that. We think about, you know, what's important to them socially. What are their, you know, what are their problems that they're facing at home, in their personal lives. What their spiritual or their psychological needs, and of course we have a whole team that we can we liaise with, that we can kind of, you know, bring in it depending on, you know, on what we identify. And I think what's particularly at the end of the placement compared to the beginning of placements, because students will say, I had this misconception that patients just come here to die, and I was, you know, I was really worried about that and how I was going to manage that. But by the end of the placement, it's very, very different. They can see that there's actually life in a hospice. It's a really lovely place to be. It's a happy place. It's supporting patients to be as independent as possible, to maintain a quality of life, you know, with their whilst they have that, you know, that changing condition.
And presumably quite a lot of them are taking a bit of a leap of faith into taking a placement here, not knowing the ins and outs of a hospice. Maybe they're a bit, as you said, a bit worried about that and anxious about that. But on the whole, the positive feedback you get from students, does that indicate that maybe you have put them on a trajectory towards considering palliative care as an option for their professional future?
Yeah, I think those students who come and are allocated a placement here, what we're trying to do more of is reaching out to the universities. So I go to Leicester University and do a teach for the morning about palliative care, the role of the physiotherapist, because there isn't that there. It's not part of the course, and the whole point of that is to demonstrate or to kind of showcase what we can offer, what you can learn from us, and because it's not your that the skills, the knowledge, and the skills that those that the students will pick up from us here across the board, you know, with the whole team, can be applied to anybody who has a long-term condition, and we know that patients are living much longer now, often with very complex illnesses, maybe 1, 2, 3 different illnesses that, you know, create a lot of symptoms and a lot of anxieties, and actually they might not be here in the hospice with us, but students, once they're qualified and they're therapists, they will see those patients in different settings. They'll see them in the hospitals, they'll see them at home in community settings, and actually what we can do here and teach them here on placement, you know, they can take that and transition those skills to other patients.
As an organisation that's a charitable organisation, there's always that element as well of actually this is what we're providing, and taking that out into the community and just showcasing what Lauros does. You know, we're one hospice that covers a very big area, but actually it's not just all on site. The students will learn all about day therapy, clinical nurse specialists, outpatients, that breadth of service that we offer. The students are also exposed to MDT working. So MDT is multidisciplinary team working. Mm-hmm. So our students will be able to see how the doctors, the medics work. They'll work with alongside the counsellors, the complementary therapists, the pharmacists, the social workers, the nurses, physios, OTs, chaplaincy, and actually how everybody together, X amount of people, are there for one person and their goals, their wishes, their family, their loved ones. And actually that's something that always comes through, really shines through in the feedback, is goodness, you know, it's just so good to hear how everybody works towards the patient. And being able to talk through, well, actually, have we covered everything? Is there anything that we're missing? Is such a privilege to be part of.
Mm-hmm. Very unlikely that they will experience an MDT elsewhere like it is within a palliative care setting.
Mm. Is that the ultimate in patient-centered care, really?
That's all
the disciplines get together to talk about every patient several times a week.
Once a week. We come together once a week, all disciplines, and anybody that's involved with that patient will give an update. We talk about any concerns that the patients might have or that us as clinicians might have, what can we do to address that. But it's everybody coming together so that we all know where each discipline is, and you know, things may have changed with that patient, physically, you know, psychologically. So it's really important that we all know, you know, how to support that patient or their family. Mm-hmm. I think that's the other thing. It's not just about supporting the patient. What we do very well here is also supporting the families and the carers. So making sure that they're
The whole unit, isn't
it? Yes, their well-being as well, because obviously they're part of that patient's journey.
Thanks, Kerry and Hannah. It's reassuring to know how patient-centred hospice care can be. If you've been moved by this and would like to know more, you can email us at info@loros.co.uk. Join us again for more insight into how we care for people at the end of their lives. Bye for now.